Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so pleased to be sitting across from Nan Calvert for Nan's last visit of 2019. Hardly seems possible that this year is already just about gone. And as we were talking before we went on the air, Nan has decided to go out of the year with a bang, with a very, very exciting array of guests that are going to be joining us today to talk about a very important topic, an issue that is, of course, very near and dear to Nan's heart. So first, Nan, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And you have assembled a trio of first-rate guests that are joining us by telephone. I want you to say a word about why you have assembled these guests and how this came about.
Well, I thought it would be a good idea to close out the year with a discussion on climate change. It's weighing heavily on a lot of the minds of people I know, including myself. We can certainly see evidence of it in the, well, for the last couple of years, during this time of year anyway, with the rather unusual weather patterns here in southeastern Wisconsin, and certainly with the great Greta Thunberg being in the news. Hopefully people are encouraged to think about this and consider what we can all do. Specifically now, of course, climate change affects every part of our lives. And as most people know, I love native plants and native plant communities. And for quite some time now, people who are absolute and utter experts in the field have been trying to figure out how it's going to affect our native plant communities, but also the invasive plant species in southeastern Wisconsin, because it's going to affect both of those. And how do we build resilient natural communities in order to withstand these changes? And so I thought it would be great to have our wonderful experts on to talk about this, and hopefully that will carry people through to the new year. And, you know, we can all think about that as a new year opens, and how can we be better Earth citizens, and what can we do to help forestall and amend what's happening?
Well, it doesn't get much more important than that. And so I'm really, really pleased now to introduce the three guests that Nan Calvert has assembled for today's program. All three of them work for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program within the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Amy Stafen, Jason Granberg, and Kelly Kearns. And I'd like each of you to explain a little bit about your particular areas of specialty or focus or expertise when it comes to the work that you do for NHC. And let's begin with Amy Stafen, please. Amy, explain what you do for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program as a conservation biologist.
Thank you, Greg. I am an ecologist with the DNR, and my professional focus is conserving native plant communities such as prairies, savannas, forests, and wetlands. And I do this by conducting biological surveys around the state, promoting landscaping with native plants, and helping managers of nature preserves address climate change.
Excellent. Jason Granberg, you are listed as an invasive species specialist. Tell us more about that.
So one of the things that I do for the department is I help coordinate some of our funding from the Pittman-Robertson Fund, which helps to control invasive species on and off DNR properties. And I'm also an ecological modeler. So I create computer models that allow us to predict which new species may occur in the landscape, as well as do some additional database work.
Very good. Finally, Kelly Kearns, who I see listed as invasive plants coordinator. Tell us more about what you do.
Okay, So I work primarily with terrestrial invasive plants, so the ones in more upland settings. And so I coordinate things from statewide with policy issues, with education and outreach, and doing a lot of work with our partner groups around the state.
Very good. And all of you are keeping very, very busy tackling the particular issue that we want to focus on today, beyond generally our concerns about invasive species, also the possibility, which is more than a possibility, it seems to be a probability and perhaps a certainty, that climate change is having some impact on the balance between our native species and our invasive species, a situation that was already troubling enough and perhaps being more complicated. Let's begin by talking more generally about climate change as it is directly impacting the state of Wisconsin. And I want to say at the outset that I think it's really important, and I'm sure you agree, that we need to do this really carefully. That, I mean, every time there's a really big thunderstorm, that's not necessarily climate change, or every time we hit a dry spell, that's not necessarily climate change. I mean, it's very easy for armchair experts to make grandiose pronouncements about how we are being affected by climate change. From a more careful scientific point of view, how do you see climate change as a reality in the habitats that surround us here in Wisconsin?
So this is Amy. I'll tackle that question. I appreciate you making that distinction about a scattered thunderstorm here and there, a drought. It is important to discriminate between weather and climate. And we make that distinction in the sense that weather is a single event that occurs in a short period of time, whereas climate and climate change are all about long-term trends and observed patterns. And in fact, we have many, many decades of data showing that climate change was going to happen and is happening. So we sometimes think we're talking about climate change in the future, but in fact, we are living in an age of climate change now. So two major climate drivers that are changing our climate are temperature and precipitation. And so in southeastern Wisconsin and throughout Wisconsin, we're seeing annual average temperatures increasing. We're experiencing more summer heat waves. Winters are warmer too, particularly with overnight temperatures. And then if we look at precipitation, rain events are increasing in frequency and intensity. And so while those discrete storms are certainly notable, these are indeed happening more and more often. So we say that's a long-term trend. That's climate change.
Hmm.
And in winter, we're seeing precipitation in the form of rain or freezing rain rather than snow. Another important thing to consider is atmospheric carbon dioxide, or CO2. And CO2 has been steadily increasing on our Earth since the start of the Industrial Revolution, mostly due to our burning of fossil fuels. And while this is one of the major drivers behind climate change, elevated CO2 also has important implications for invasive plant growth and management. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. So that's kind of a summary of climate change in Wisconsin. And if you'd like, I could go ahead and talk a little bit about how that will affect the land and its plant communities. Would you like me to do that now, or did you have any questions about the previous?
I have two brief follow-ups. First of all, it's probably important. I mean, I think it goes without saying, but nevertheless, let's go ahead and say it, that when we talk about climate change in Wisconsin, I am assuming that climate change in Wisconsin looks very, very similar to climate change in Minnesota and climate change in Michigan, that there isn't anything particularly unique about what we are experiencing. And I should think that adjacent states are experiencing climate change in nearly identical fashion. Would you say that, for instance, the presence of Lake Michigan and Lake Superior Do those have particular effects on how we are experiencing climate change versus what, for instance, the citizens of a place like North Dakota or South Dakota are experiencing? Or by and large, would most of the Midwestern states be experiencing the same kind of realities that you just outlined?
That's a great question, Greg. In general, I'd say some of the coarse scale climate trends are similar throughout the upper Midwest. But even within the state of Wisconsin, say moving from south to north, you're going to see slightly different patterns. Even soils can have some impact on how climate changes. We see different trends for sandier parts of the state, for example. And definitely the Great Lakes also have some impact on climate change. And Kelly and Jason, feel free to chime in, but like Lake Michigan in particular, well, the Great Lakes are going to see warming trends and greater wind speeds that cause more wave action and subsidence along the coastlines. And I believe that the temperatures of Lake Michigan do help moderate, and those winds help moderate temperatures along the coastline.
And another tool that we have available to us is it's through the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. They have a tool that is a climate analog matching tool. So you can click on a portion of Wisconsin and see how that particular area may look like other climates in other states nearby. So areas that would be in southwestern Wisconsin, they're going to appear more like areas of Missouri and Kansas, while areas that are going to be along the Lake Michigan coastline, they may appear more like areas of Virginia. Northern Wisconsin will look like southern Wisconsin in the future.
Wow. That's
yeah, so one other thing to keep in mind is that we have a fairly narrow band of boreal forest in our northern part of the state, whereas Minnesota has a much, much larger region of boreal forest. So as those boreal forests are essentially being lost in some ways to increasing temperatures, then there's more of a buffer over in Minnesota than there is here.
I also want to return to the matter of weather versus climate. Given the fact that, at least here in southeastern Wisconsin, we experienced a November unlike any recent November, but it wasn't because we lacked snow, but in fact got this huge amount of snow. I mean, nearly unprecedented, certainly in recent years. We just haven't had that kind of snow, and that's a bit at odds with the general trend. And of course, you don't even have to be an ardent climate change skeptic, just kind of a regular person looking out the window, you know, probably wonders, well, then how do you explain November? And I suppose this goes back to that distinction between weather and climate, and the fact that any kind of trend, even a really strong trend, is going to have these interruptions in that trend. And we, I suppose, need to learn to interpret those interruptions in trends or these relatively isolated incidents. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and I hope I can paint a picture in everyone's minds. If you think of a graph showing the trend of temperatures over time, it's going to be a zigzaggy line going up, down, up, down, up, down. But if you draw a line through all of those points, the trend is gradually and up, inexorably upward, getting higher and higher. But you're right, there are interannual variations, but the long-term trend is warmer and warmer, and those changes in precipitation that I talked about.
One of the things that some of our meteorologists have been working on is figuring out how changes at the poles are impacting changes at lower latitudes. And we know that in the Arctic, the temperature changes and climate changes are much more extreme than they are down here. And so as the poles are, as the Arctic is warming, that's pushing those cold air masses further south in some cases. So that's when we get those polar vortexes that are occurring, and we get those extreme cold temperatures.
Interesting. Amy Stafen, I think we kind of interrupted what you where you wanted to take us next in terms of now entering the topic of how climate change is affecting our landscapes.
Yeah, no, you no problem interrupting. That was a really good discussion to kind of lay the groundwork for understanding climate change. So now let's just dig a little deeper and think about how that's going to affect the native plant communities that Nan loves so much, and also the invasive species. And Kelly and Jason, please chime in. But just some general principles. First of all, since the onset of spring is shifting to be earlier with those warming temps, and the onset of fall is shifting later, plants have a longer growing season. And so that can affect our native plants, but also those invasive plants. And it seems like the invasives are better at really taking advantage of that additional time to just be growing. Increasing temperatures and more heat waves can lead to drought and heat stress for plants. But again, those invasives sometimes seem to do just fine. Those frequent and intense storms can cause flooding. And those floodwaters can carry sediment and nutrient-laden runoff into waterways and wetlands. And those are the perfect conditions for invasive species to get established and to get dispersed.
And when they do have that runoff, there's also seeds of these invasives getting transported, as well as plant parts that can actually start new populations very easily. So one of the areas where we'll be seeing a lot more invasive plants in the near future is along floodplains.
For those of you just joining us, this is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and she has assembled for us today three experts from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources who all work for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program, Amy Stafen, Jason Granberg, and Kelly Kearns, who all in one way or another are, as you can already hear, experts in the whole area of invasive plants versus native plants, and also have done some study on the impact of climate change on all of this. This would be probably a good point to pause and just make sure that everybody listening has perfect clarity when it comes to the definitions of what is an invasive species versus what is a native species. And we've actually had considerable conversations about invasive species, especially invasive plant species, on this program. So I don't think we need to go into an enormous amount of detail, but maybe tell us what you think is important for us to know about this whole notion of invasive species versus native species within the context of what we're talking about today.
Sure. So native species are those species that evolved in a particular area. And so in Wisconsin, they're the species that have been here for hundreds of years, pretty much developed since the last glacial period. And the invasive species are a small percentage of the non-native species that have been introduced into an area. We have hundreds of species of non-native species that are brought in for landscaping and agricultural purposes and lots of other purposes. And a small percentage of those happen to be species that do really well with some of the perturbances in the landscape that Amy was mentioning. So they do great with increased sedimentation and increased nutrient runoff and with higher CO2 in the atmosphere. And oftentimes they reproduce both by seed and vegetatively. And so they have all these extra advantages over our native species. And so these are the species that we really are concerned about. Some of them are already widespread and abundant in the state. A lot of people are familiar with things like buckthorn and garlic mustard and reed canary grass. Others are not yet here, the ones that we're very concerned about, but we think they'll be here pretty soon. A lot of people are familiar with kudzu. It's it's in numerous places in Illinois, and it potentially could easily be in southeast Wisconsin if it was introduced. And we know that with climate change, we will have we are having increased CO2 in the atmosphere, which actually increases the potential for those very weedy, viney species like kudzu and our native poison ivy to really do really well and outcompete other species. And then the same with some of these species that grow along floodplains, like some of the grasses, like Japanese stilt grass that, as far as we know, is not here yet, but we're expecting to find it soon. So these are the kind of species that we really want to be able to get a handle on before they take off and become the next garlic mustard.
When you say when such and such is introduced, I mean, for instance, a given invasive species that is not here yet, but potentially could be here, could be introduced here at some point, at least generally speaking, how does that introduction, as you phrase it, happen?
It can happen a lot of ways. Initially, they get into the country through either intentional introductions, like kudzu was brought in for agricultural purposes. A lot of these things brought in for horticultural purposes. Or they can be brought in accidentally. The Japanese stilt grass was brought in probably accidentally. And then once they're in the country, it's pretty easy for a lot of these things to get moved around. They can get moved around on camping equipment, on the soles of people's shoes, on the fur of dogs, in streams, and wind is moving these things around. So, for example, that stilt grass, when I visit my sister's property in southern Indiana, it's all over the place. And if I don't clean my shoes well before I come back to Wisconsin, I could potentially be introducing it. And so it's important that people are aware that they have that potential to be moving things around when they move from one place to another.
And I just want to interject that it's very, very important when you're going to places to buy plants that you intend to put in your yard, that you have some sense of this particular concept, that oftentimes it's introduced by the horticultural industry. So I can give you an example. A couple of years ago, a local big box store was selling, and I don't know the botanical name, but it's broom grass, which is highly invasive. And fortunately, someone from Southeast Wisconsin Invasive Species Consortium saw it and talked to the manager and explained what was going on. The manager then called the corporate office, and it was eventually pulled from the shelves of this particular big box store. And I realize that not everybody is aware of what's trending in the invasive species world, and not everybody really understands that invasive species move in various ways. They don't just stay put. That's why, you know, buckthorn and honeysuckle and garlic mustard are sort of ubiquitous in our landscape. So it's just really important for places that sell plants and people who buy plants from a conventional horticultural application to you know, be aware of what goes on when you put non-native species in your landscapes.
Yeah, I think that, Nan, the plant you're probably talking about is Scotch broom.
Scotch broom,
found
exactly.
In a big box store a few years ago. Fortunately, that was one of the species that we already had regulated as an invasive species in Wisconsin and a prohibited invasive species because it's not yet widespread in the state.
Right.
And so thanks to our Department of Agriculture, who helps us with inspecting these places, we were able to get them to stop the sale of that right away. And so we do have this rule in Wisconsin called NR40, and it is our invasive species rule that has a pretty long list of plants and animals that are regulated as either prohibited, meaning you can't buy and sell them, transfer them, and if they're found in the state, we want them gotten rid of because so they don't create a new population. And then we also have the restricted species, which you also cannot buy or sell, but they are much more widespread, and so people aren't required to control them. And those are the things like the buckthorns and honeysuckles.
I am finding myself understanding some terminology that I was going to ask you about, but even though I think I have it clear, I think it might be good for our listeners to hear this. And that is, I was going to at some point ask, are all invasive species bad? I mean, is it possible for something to be non-native and yet not the kind of threat that we are talking about? And the more you're talking about this, the more I'm realizing that that in a sense there is a difference between a non-native plant or a non-native mussel or whatever we might be talking about, something being non-native versus something being invasive. And that term invasive is used very deliberately. And that so maybe my one remaining question is, theoretically, it's possible to have something that is a non-native plant that's not an invasive plant because of, in a sense, the way it acts. Is that a fair distinction to make?
Yes, Greg, that's a really good distinction to make. A lot of people equate those two, and it's definitely not accurate to do that. We have many, many non-native plants that are not invasive in the state. Horticultural plants, agricultural plants, probably 90-plus percent of the non-native plants that are grown in the state are not invasive.
Hmm. Can we also make sure that we are being clear about what we're talking about in terms of invasive species? Because, of course, there are invasive species that are not plants. Remind our listeners of just kind of the wide array of invasive species that we need to be concerned about that are not plants at all, that grow in the ground. And there are certainly some that we, for instance, have really heard a lot about here in southeastern Wisconsin, but there's probably others that with which we would be less acquainted.
So this is Jason. So we have other invasive species that we need to be concerned about. Some of them include in aquaculture. So it's spiny water flea. There are the zebra and quagga mussels. There are other red bloody shrimp is another one. We're also concerned about monk parakeets. So we have a variety of other species we're concerned about beyond just plants.
Wow. I've heard about, of course, the zebra mussels and some of those others, but you're going to have to tell us about this scary parakeet that you just mentioned.
So the monk parakeet, it's a domestic parrot, parakeet that people have as a pet.
And excuse me, did you say M-O-N-K, monk parakeet?
Yes, monk parakeet. Mm-hmm. And with this parakeet, it's a colonial nester. So if it's able to escape into the environment, what they'll do is they'll grow these nests in one large colony, and sometimes they'll build them on top of electrical power stations or other high power lines. And because of that structure, it can then be a problem for electrical companies.
Oh, interesting. So it's not so much that they are going to wipe out other native bird populations, but they are going to create other kinds of problems for us, for human beings.
Yes.
Yeah, so an invasive species can actually cause economic or health harm as well as ecological harm.
Right. So one thing... Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So there's another suite of species that are important to consider, and that's insects, and especially forest pests. With climate change, our trees are becoming stressed as they're exposed to drought and extreme heat, and this stress actually increases their susceptibility to pests and diseases. So I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the emerald ash borer, and that definitely is one species that will benefit from climate change as the trees become stressed, and some insects are even attracted to trees that are stressed. They somehow sense that.
One of the points of confusion is when we talk about general trends that involve rising temperatures and rising precipitations, but then we talk about periods of drought. So are we talking about climate change creating wilder extremes? Or just for instance, what are the long-term trends when it comes to something like precipitation?
So in general, we will be having more precipitation in the state, but the nature in which the precipitation is coming down is changing. So we will have those really frequent and intense storms, especially in the spring, but fall too. But then you have more periods of drought or dryness in between those rain events. And when you have these extreme storm events, dumping tons of water in the landscape in a short amount of time, the water doesn't get sufficient time to infiltrate to the water table necessarily. And sometimes it just flows quickly across the landscape, especially in the winter if we get rain instead of snow. And then the ground is frozen and the water just flows across the landscape, and we end up entering the spring with a drought condition where under normal winter conditions you'd have the snow slowly melting and infiltrating the soil. So we are seeing more droughts, and then we're seeing more summer heat waves that also contribute to drought.
Interesting. And so even when we are receiving precipitation, it might be in a sense the wrong kind of precipitation, or we are receiving it in the wrong, or it's precipitation that's being delivered in the wrong way. And so that's how we can, for instance, have a whole lot of rain and yet not have the sort of profound relief from drought that we might expect from big rains.
Yeah, you got it.
One other question before we turn to what's really important as a next step, namely what is being done about all this. I think it would be good to get some clarification on why it is that our native species suffer while so many invasive species seem to flourish in climate change. It seems like something as serious as climate change should hurt everything and everyone in relatively equal measure. But it sounds like there are ways in which invasive species, by their very nature, find their well-being enhanced, just the opposite of what might be the effect on our native species. Help us better understand why that strange reality is in place.
Sure. So with any kind of ecological balance, there's winners and losers. And so in a situation where you have native plants that have been adapted to a particular type of set of ecological restraints for, you know, decades, centuries, they are used to being growing in that fairly consistent type of environment. When you have these extreme changes that are happening, it's harder for those plants to adapt to those changes. And whereas the invasive plants, these are the ones that have already self-selected as being the ones that are particularly adaptable. And so of those several hundred plants that have been introduced from other places in Wisconsin, we have a small number that have self-selected to be, you know, really good at being able to adapt to these rapid changes, to be able to handle increased sedimentation, increased nutrient flow, those kind of things. A good example is in prairies. Generally, prairies like fairly low nutrients input. When you have a lot of agricultural runoff into a prairie environment, and then you get a lot of nitrogen, and you get a weedy area into the prairies, because the weedy non-native species tend to do really well with those high nutrients, whereas the native species didn't need that. They were doing just fine without that increased input. So it's easier for this select group of invasives to adapt than it is for these species that have been evolved in the area for a long time.
You can kind of think of it in a way as invasive plants or non-native plants don't necessarily have the predators that they would have in their natural environment, wherever they came from. And so, for example, when we think about purple loosestrife that is growing in so many of our wetlands, you know, just grew without any restraints at all. But then when the beetle was, it was discovered that there's a particular beetle in purple loosestrife's native land that would eat it, and that beetle was raised here in southeastern Wisconsin and released on purple loosestrife. It ate the purple loosestrife. It didn't eat any of the other native plants, and then our native plants were able to outcompete the purple loosestrife because purple loosestrife's predator was there. So sometimes it's easier to understand if there's an insect-plant relationship that goes on. Once that's removed, the plant doesn't doesn't have any checks and balances anymore. It can just do whatever it wants to do. And so certainly with buckthorn and honeysuckle and garlic mustard and all of the other common ones like teasel and other things, they don't have any checks and balances here. And so they can just ride roughshod over everything else.
Interesting. So in a sense, it's not just the invasive species itself that's the problem, but the fact that their predators aren't here to keep them in check.
And their soil conditions, their specific soil conditions, their specific weather conditions. You know, again, I say it pretty much on every show, everything is related, everything is connected. And when you break those connections, you end up with some pretty wonky stuff that can go on.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, Nan Calvert is on hand for her monthly visit to our program, and we are so honored to have with us three people who work for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Amy Stafen, Jason Granberg, and Kelly Kearns. I was visiting your website and was gratified to see that a lot has been done. I mean, a tremendous amount of work has been done and is being done and will continue to be done to try to tackle some of these issues. I am anxious to hear much, much more about some of the progress that is being made, and specifically the work being done by the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Tell us more about that.
This is Amy. I could tell you about that. So Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, or also called WICI, was formed by the DNR and UW in 2007 and has grown to include a network of collaborators from various agencies, institutions, tribes, NGOs. And their website is WICI, wicci.wisc.edu. And Kelly and Jason and I are active in a working group with under the WICI umbrella, the Plants and Natural Communities Working Group. And we have been working with partners to develop a toolkit of adaptation resources for people who manage natural areas. This includes lists of ideas for on-the-ground adaptation, and we're trying to develop real-life climate adaptation demonstration sites. And we've also done vulnerability assessments for our various native plant communities in Wisconsin. So we have climate vulnerability assessments for the prairies and the forests, the woodlands and the wetlands. All of those are posted on our WICI website.
You know, I was just, when you mentioned how our climate will resemble Missouri and Virginia at some point in the future. It just made me think of all of our native plant species that require a freeze and thaw period for their seed casings to split in order to germinate, you know, and how potentially how much less we will see those species and perhaps we won't see them at all at some point.
Right, and that's part of those vulnerability assessments, and that was really astute. I'm actually going to make a note of that because I don't think we thought of that previously. I did want to say that in general, if people do want to plant native plants that are going to be resilient, I think the prairie plants are still the best way to go. You know, they're adapted to drought, heat, and oak trees are projected to have a consistent habitat in Wisconsin into the future. So I think the key is to minimize soil disturbance and get lots of healthy prairie plants growing to compete with any possible invasives that are coming in.
We've had a couple of segments on soil because it's the least lauded of our important natural resources. You know, we don't learn about the importance of soil, and it's interesting to me that earlier you said that soil conditions also impact climate change. And so once again, that points out that, you know, soil is an equal player in this. You know, it's not just water and air and plants and animals. It's also soil. It comes part and parcel. Again, everything is connected. Everything is in relationship, and you can't forget about one thing at all, and especially soil. And you know, we were talking about earlier, we mentioned that, you know, so much rain happens in a short amount of time and then we don't have any rain. And I think it's difficult for some people who live in the cities and suburbs to realize the immediate impact of that. But when you drive around in more rural and agricultural areas in southeastern Wisconsin, you can see it right away. The soil is super saturated at this point, and there are huge pools of standing water. And the same happened last fall as well. A lot of farm fields were abandoned this year because they never dried out enough. Crops went in really late, and they were harvested really late. You know, so we're seeing how weather patterns are affected by climate change and what's happening in the real world as a result of it.
So I wonder if when you are thinking about what ordinary people, ordinary citizens can do, are your suggestions more about what we can do to try to curb climate change itself, or is it more about dealing with the effects of climate change and trying to affect whatever remedies we can on that end of the process? I mean, what do you want the average listener hearing all of this to do about what they're hearing?
So one of the ways that the public can help us out with our invasive species programs is to help us with any new detections. Species that are first starting to enter into the landscape, they're a lot easier to control. So we have an email address. If someone finds a new invasive species, or if they're finding species that are acting irregularly, they can send us a report at invasive.species@wisconsin.gov, and along with that, give us some information about who you are, if you've got a photograph of the species, and perhaps some size estimates. That would help us out with any other planning and control activities.
Hmm. And location.
And what was that address again?
invasive.species@wisconsin.gov.
And so it probably helps if people have some sense of something being invasive. And of course, it's probably as good a time as any to remind people that invasive species are only ugly in what they do, but they can be very pretty to look at. So it's not like it looks like something that belongs in a witch's cauldron. That's not how you know something is invasive. Is it just when something appears that is unfamiliar? Is that reason enough to reach out to you?
It would be more along the lines if you saw an area that was only that only had that one given species. They form these dense, expansive monocultures that exclude all the other plants in the area.
The other thing people can do, of course, is get familiar with some of these plants. They can go to our website and many other websites to look and see what some of these species are and help to identify that. There are apps to help people identify plants as well. And if you go on our website, we also have a reporting system called the Great Lakes Early Detection Network. It's an app that you can actually go on and report invasive plants. And even if you're not real sure what it is, you take a photo of it, and it already automatically gives you the location. And so then those photos go to someone who can verify what it is. And so that's another really good way to do that. And all of that's on the DNR website if you type in the keyword invasive.
Very good.
And our website is dnr.wi.gov.
I wanted to close by saying that when I was looking at the website for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program specifically, or some of the materials related to what you do, it was really gratifying to see some good news there. Not just doom and gloom, but I mean, I remember a couple of things like promising numbers about monarch butterflies and something about a rare ground squirrel that is making a comeback. I mean, there is good news in all of this, and it's probably important to emphasize that for people who, I mean, in an area where it can really be easy to be discouraged.
So we just put out an annual report that identifies a lot of those good news projects and some of the things that we're working on. And so that can also be found on the regular DNR webpage and the Natural Heritage Conservation page as well.
Great. Well, we are so grateful to all three of you for joining us to talk about the important work that you do and about this really important issue that affects so many of us in so many different ways. Amy Stafen, Jason Granberg, and Kelly Kearns, all with the Natural Heritage Conservation Program for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We thank you so much for your time and wish you well, you and all of your colleagues, in the important work that you continue to do for our state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, all of that was quite exciting and illuminating. And to finish out, I assume you have some calendar events for us, even in this busy month of December. There are plenty of things going on related to what we're talking about with your visits.
Yes. You know what? There are dozens of things going on, and unfortunately, we only have time for about three of them. So let's start out with this year's Christmas bird count. It's the 120th year nationwide for the Christmas bird count. It has become an exceptionally valuable tool to monitor winter bird range and numbers of bird populations, which we know are changing noticeably. So in general, for information about Christmas bird count, you can go to www.christmasbirdcount, that's one word, .org. Specifically for our area, in Racine, the Christmas bird count will take place on December 14th. In Burlington, it's December 15th. In Kenosha, it is December 21st. Each of those three areas has its own coordinator or contact person. To find out who that is, just go to Hoy Audubon, that's one word, .org, and their names and contact information and what you need to do will be there. This is a great event for all ages, and there's a lot of different ways to do the Christmas bird count. So it's a really fun family activity and an important one to be involved in.
Well, and especially in the context of what we talked about on today's program, it's even more important for us to know what's out there and in what numbers and where they are and what numbers are going up and what numbers are going down.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they mentioned the monk parakeet. You know, if you see one, it needs to be reported. Or if you see numbers of them, it needs to be reported. Now, the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center is having its winter solstice celebration on Friday, December 20th from 6 p.m. until 7:30. You'll gather to celebrate the beginning of winter with reflection and music. This event is free and it is for all ages. Please bring an appetizer to share. And next, Riverbend Nature Center on December 14th from 9 to noon is having its 7th annual Gifts of Nature program. So you go to Riverbend to create up to 8 beautiful gifts using components found in nature. People 7 years and up are encouraged to attend. All the materials are included. There will be live music, cookies, and hot cocoa on hand. It's $40 for members and $45 for those who are yet to be members of Riverbend Nature Center. Hmm. And that's it.
Very good. Nan Calvert, thank you for all that you have contributed to the morning show through the course of 2019, and especially today's really exciting and informative program. It was terrific. A great way to finish out the year, and it makes me excited for 2020.
Yeah, we were talking before we went on about we have some exceptional scientists within the Wisconsin DNR, and I was just so happy to have three of them on so that people can hear what's going on. Thank you very much. 2019 has been wonderful. I look forward to 2020, and I wish everybody very happy holidays and a happy new year.
Best wishes. Thank you again, Nan. And tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be previewing the Kenosha Symphony's holiday concert this weekend and also a sing-along performance of Handel's Messiah Sunday night at 6, a performance which I will be conducting. And next week, we'll have a full slate of morning show programs, including an interview which has been preempted twice because of impeachment hearings. I really hope that finally this Monday I'll be able to air my interview with Lydia Pine, the author of a very intriguing book called Genuine Fakes, which talks about kind of the fuzzy line sometimes between what is fake and what is real. Next Tuesday, we'll be talking about an intriguing new production of A Christmas Carol from the Fleeing Artists of Theater Company in Kenosha. We'll talk about the Racine Theater Guild's production of Wizard of Oz, which opens this weekend and which, I'm sad to tell you, is already sold out. Good news for the Guild. Sad news for anybody who does not have a ticket for this really wonderful production. Next Thursday, Brian Albrecht will pay his monthly visit to the morning show. And next Friday, we'll be highlighting a number of brand new books that are just out in time for Christmas. The morning show airs every weekday morning between